the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Natasha Moore.
And I'm Simon Smart.
The great American Catholic writer Flannery O'Connor once claimed that it was impossible to write religious fiction anymore, that you can't write a novel about religion in a society that isn't religious. She said that no one will have the least idea what you are about.
But one of today's most celebrated novelists, Marilyn Robinson, spoke with me about this. Her novels are profoundly theological, but it doesn't seem to stop people of all faiths and none from falling in love with her work.
I get, you know, very, very positive reviews from people who say they are not religious and who publish in periodicals that are not notoriously, you know, oriented in that way. I have only found generous responses. It's a hard thing. In this country, there's a tendency, which I appreciate, to suppress the awareness of religious difference in a great many settings, for example, my great big university here. So as a kind of manners, in effect, you don't hear much religious conversation in the ordinary course of things. Then everybody goes to synagogue or mosque or wherever. But
it seems like there's a gap between what people talk about in public and what's going on underneath for them.
The fact that this kind of speech is not conventional doesn't mean that people are not religious themselves, don't have religious thoughts, you know. I think that a lot of people are quite dependent on there being some kind of reasonable public conversation that allows of this kind of thinking. I think that the great power of someone like Martin Luther King is that he was able to speak in a religious language that people recognized and felt was compelling, you know. People, I think, participate in a kind of surface secularism, knowing that that's what it is, but they see secularism around them and assume that it's profound in other people, you know. It's not a simple thing.
It's not a simple thing, but it's something that we often say rather casually. We live in a secular society without asking what that word really means.
Now, it's possible this sounds like a really boring topic when I said, hey, let's do an episode on secularism. Not everybody in the CPX office jumped up and down with excitement, let's say. But even though this is complicated and can seem quite abstract, it has big implications for how we actually do life together in a culture where not everybody believes the same things.
Yeah, I actually think it is interesting, Natasha. We've asked a few experts to help us with this, and I think they've come in handy. And the first thing they all tell us is that secular doesn't simply mean anti-religious or even just non-religious. Although this is the way we often use it now, you know, religious or secular government, religious or secular schools.
But Ian Benson, he's a legal philosopher who's writing on secularism, has been cited by the highest courts in Canada and South Africa. He says that the origins of this word secular are very different from what we think.
Historically, secular comes from the term secularum, which means the age or the times. And that was seen in contradistinction to eternity. So that within the Catholic tradition, you have to this day two orders of clergy, secular clergy and regular clergy. Secular clergy are those that are where? In the world. They're in the times. They're in the age. Regular clergy are in the monastery. They're dedicated to prayer and eternity, but they're both religious. This is very important.
Related to this is the provocative idea that actually everyone is a believer of some kind.
While there may be people who don't believe in certain propositions, they don't believe in Jesus as the Son of God, they don't believe in religion as having validity and so on, everybody's a believer. The question isn't whether you're a believer, it's what you believe in. And this is a problem because it lines up with other bifurcations like religion and the secular, like communities of faith. All communities are communities of faith. If everyone's a believer and all our communities are communities of faith, by which I mean we gather around things we believe in, then by operating with this implied idea that only religions contain beliefs and faith, we leave out of analysis all of this rich and important faith and belief commitments that animate and drive contemporary cultures, whether they know it or not.
Professor Benson is really calling into question this idea that you can neatly hive off religion from this other, much bigger realm called the secular. In reality, we all bring our beliefs to the table when we engage with other people, and we all get those beliefs from somewhere, whether from a religious tradition or not. So the question of what a secular society looks like or should or could look like is not about eliminating certain beliefs from the public square, but about how we treat all beliefs.
Someone else we talked to about this was Craig Calhoun, who is an American sociologist. At the time we spoke with him, he was still the head of the London School of Economics.
In politics, we often think, oh, there must be no mention of religion, that secularism means no mention of religion. But it's also possible to think of it as meaning fairness in reference to different religions. And so in a country like India that has millions of Muslims and millions of Hindus and not a few Christians and Buddhists and others, the secular isn't the domain of a society with no religion. It's the ability of people from different religious backgrounds to talk about the government that they share in common and other goals that they share in common without being prejudicial towards one religion or another.
But then whenever we talk about this topic, people will say, what about the separation of church and state? Isn't that pretty key for modern secular societies?
The United States has in its constitution the famous doctrine of the separation of religion and the state, separation of church and state. There are two misunderstandings about this. One, this really comes into focus as doctrine only after the Civil War. But two, the original constitutional provision had to do with the freedom of the different colonies each to have a religion and not to have to agree on one religion they would all have. And so there were colonies that were Catholic, and there were colonies that were Quaker, and there were colonies that were Congregationalist. And so they made the declaration of the separation of the church and state to allow religion to flourish, not to try to stop it. And the secular, therefore, meant the ability to build institutions, including state institutions, that didn't depend on any one religion, rather than the necessity of getting rid of religion.
So the way we often use the word secular as the opposite of religious is a bit sloppy and doesn't reflect either the history or the reality today.
The guy who wrote the book on this, an 800-page book called A Secular Age, is Charles Taylor. He talks about three different senses of the word secular. First, he says, people are less religious than they used to be, that religious affiliation has declined in Western countries, which is true. A second one is about society more widely, when religion is playing less of a role in government and how things are run, also accurate. But there's a third sense of secular, and this is the one that Charles Taylor thinks is kind of more interesting, and this is to do with what he calls the conditions of belief. So, you know, what's shifted isn't just that fewer people are religious or that our culture is less religious, it's that actually whatever you believe, you're always aware of other options in a way that people didn't used to be. Here's Professor Taylor.
The world can be missing something essential for the meaning in your life. And because there's so many different reactions here, you can't just say, oh, it automatically must be. No, but the possibility of feeling something missing is always there. And as we share this space and people see that, well, they're living without it, but some people are not, and there's something striking about them, right? So then you get worried. Maybe I'm wrong about there being no transcendence. And on the other hand, people who are living a certain kind of transcendence wonder why these people manage to live without it. So we're always unsettling each other's stance on that. But that means that the issue never goes away. And it won't. It's clear that it's not going to go away.
That was philosopher Charles Taylor talking about the disenchantment of the modern world. He's saying that even if you're the most devout believer, even if you're the staunchest atheist, none of us can help looking over the fence at one another's belief systems. That's what our modern secular age looks like. People are still Christians or atheists or Muslims or whatever, but it's never uncomplicated because we all live alongside people who we know see the world differently from us. And that changes our experience of belief, whatever beliefs we do or don't hold.
You're listening to Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart, and Natasha Moore. So far, we've been considering perhaps one of the most loaded words in our language today, the word secular, and trying to figure out what it really means. Our experts say that secular doesn't traditionally mean non-religious, but rather not favouring any religion over another. Secularism doesn't eject religion, try to get rid of it. It just tries to treat different ones fairly. Still, people do more and more use the word secular to mean not religious or even anti-religious, and language is fluid, so if people use it that way, it comes to mean that. So we thought it would be worth asking then, what gets lost? What might we miss out on if that logic follows through? If living in a secular society did end up meaning a religion-free public square?
What does Christianity have to offer public conversation state? Well, it offers lots of different language. That's a first thing. And we draw on a history.
This is Craig Calhoun again.
Religious metaphors and images and poetry. For example, the idea of Exodus and the Exodus story of moving in freedom from slavery mattered for those who fought actual slavery in the early 19th century and still fight slavery around the world today. But it matters also metaphorically for people who imagine a better life, free from some ways in which they're being dominated. And there are other examples of how the poetry of religious language matters. But religion also matters because it calls attention to the nature of our relationships with each other and our relationships to the world. Sometimes we could think of these as secular, but we could see a religious meaning to the secular. For example, a moral obligation to act with stewardship towards nature and to say it's not just a bunch of stuff that's there with no value. It has value as part of God's creation, and we have obligations to use it carefully and to take care of it, to steward it for the future. And that extends into ideas about relationships with each other. Religion informs being able to think better about our obligations to those who are less well off, to be able to think better about our obligations to those who have not yet been born and to the future. Do we use up all the natural resources? Do we damage the planet irrevocably? Or do we feel that we have a kind of moral obligation to the future? Well, we gain an ability to be articulate about these things, in part from religious traditions. And we see this exemplified, for example, in the popularity of the Pope and his ability to not only write encyclicals about these things, but in a sense, touch people and move them.
What he's saying here is that when we edit out religious ideas and language from different spheres of life, media, politics, entertainment, and so on, we lose some of our resources for thinking about things well, expressing things well. Religion, at the very least, taps into this well of human experience, and if we lose that, we're all worse off.
One of the areas that Professor Calhoun talks about where we have seen this strong secularizing tendency is the realm of higher education.
I think the modern university has often participated in the forgetting of the significance of religion and the compartmentalization of religion. So maybe you'd have a religious studies department, but surely it had nothing to do with economics. Well, it's not so clear that it has nothing to do with economics if you think about the religiously inspired critiques of capitalism, or if you think about the role of religious networks and religious prayer meetings in knitting together some groups of highly active businessmen. And the principle is more widespread than that. We need to be able to discuss the things that are shaping our world. In universities, we need to be able to do research about them, we need to be able to debate them, and we need to be able to teach about them, we need to be able to invite students to express their different views. Religion is part of that. If we let it dominate, if we say religious conformity controls the university, we lose all of that capacity. But if we banish it, we also lose a lot of that capacity because we can no longer discuss the history of important things. We can no longer discuss the beliefs and ideas of a significant part of our population. And we can no longer engage some of the basic contrasts between civilizations in the world. And so we have a flattened, shallower understanding of the world.
For people who want to believe that we've outgrown or are outgrowing religion altogether, this vision of religion being closely integrated into how we understand and discuss the world might be unappealing. But it's very clear that religion, even in the most secular Western societies, isn't going anywhere. So it makes sense for us all to figure out how to listen to each other and include one another. Let's give the last word here to Charles Taylor, author of A Secular Age.
There's a tremendous impoverishment of human life if I only understand one way of being in this world in which one of the striking facts is that human beings live by very different sources of meaning. So I can't understand anybody outside my own little circle. And then I justify that by saying that they're all wrong or superstitious or crazy and so on, right? And that's a tremendous human loss on two levels. I mean, first of all, maybe to work out a really mature faith, we need to understand what the options are. And certainly to get on with people of very different faiths, we need to stop caricaturing them, right? Stop thinking that they're just diminished versions of ourselves. So for these two reasons, I think that kind of narrative is catastrophic in a society like ours.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart, and Natasha Moore.
You might like to listen to this episode again. There's a lot in there. You can do that on our website, publicchristianity.org, or on iTunes. Just type CPX into the search box to find us. While you're there, feel free to leave us a rating or a review. It helps other people to find our show.
Next week, we're back looking at some places in the world that do things very differently from Western secular societies. We speak with Nick and Ruth Ripkin about their work in places like Somalia, China, and Iraq, a long way from their native Kentucky. We hope you join us then.